Hello, interwebs, and welcome to Close Up. I'm your host, Joe, and with me today, standing in for Ryan, is Justin.
Hello.
Viewers of video on YouTube might notice that we have a new set today. That's because recording online sucks. If you can help it, better to do it in person. But enough preamble, we have a new and improved Leisure List segment, and that's not just down to the new set. We're changing the rules up this time. We are going to be telling you what we're covering today up front, so no guesswork, no having to read through the descriptions. And we are going to be going into medium-level spoilers for everything today. Could be more heavy spoilers, depending on the topic, but we're going to try to avoid big twist endings at the very least. It's just hard to keep these things interesting for so long when you're trying to censor yourself as you go. So that's a factor as well. And we will also be, come hell or high water, trying to keep these things under an hour and a half. So in that spirit, let's share our lists. So headlining today is going to be Skeleton Crew. And then I've got Gladiator 2, Dune Prophecy, A Complete Unknown, Pride and Prejudice, 2005, The Devil's Advocate, The World's End, The Master, It's a Wonderful Life, Kindergarten Cop, Roadhouse, Anna Karenina, Annie, 1982, Journey to Bethlehem, Simpsons, Season 13, Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey, Fanboys. I watch a lot of things. This is roughly for December to January.
That's a lot. That's a lot.
Oh, and this was just the stuff that I chose to cut out. By the way, new rules. Also, I'm cutting out comic books and novels at the very least. So this is just my pared down list. It could have been even longer. What do you have?
So I've got Dan to Dan, Spaceman, Beastars Season 1, 2, 3, Kingsglaive, ReZero Season 1 and 2, Hooked, Overlord Light Novel 1.
Okay, that's good. So let's kick off with Skeleton Crew. We actually watched this one together, so that makes it the easiest for a fact. And I want to say first off, I'm very disappointed that this show is not doing better. I don't know what it is about Disney Plus Star Wars that the absolute worst things or mediocre things, basically everything from the Book of Boba Fett or Ahsoka or I can't even remember what else they've done now, that the Acolyte, all these things get so much press and a lot of people watch them and the outrage about them is very strong. And then you get stuff that's actually good, like Andor and Skeleton Crew, that's just buried for some reason, both on the Disney homepages and in fan discourse. I don't understand why the actual good Star Wars content is not promoted. And then it dies, and they don't want to renew it for season two, probably, because viewership was considerably lower. And these shows cost a lot to make. So I don't know what Disney's doing. I think their producers must just have very bad taste for what they choose to pour untold millions into marketing. And they let the stuff people actually enjoy die a neglectful death.
Yeah, it's a shame that they just didn't, like half the people I've talked to didn't even know this was a show that existed. Like, it's ridiculous.
And the other half of people I know started the show and never seemed to follow through. Just because they forget it's coming out. I think you and I are the only ones I know who actually finished this thing. Everyone else I know was like, oh, well, yeah, I'm going to start it. I'm definitely going to start it. Or they started it and then just trail off on other things.
Yeah, like it didn't even come up first on Disney Plus. Like it was supposed to be the big release of the week, and it's like, oh, and it's where the heck is it?
Yeah. It's look, so that is the story surrounding Skeleton Crew, but let's get into Skeleton Crew because there's a lot to celebrate here in terms of not just Star Wars content, but personally, this is a pretty darn good show, just in general. It's a stellar throwback to 1980s classics like The Goonies. And it's very much in that vein. It feels like a movie that would have been made back then, but with modern effects and budgeting. And it's an excellent showcase for practical puppetry. And I think the special effects are astounding in the show. The CGI looks phenomenal. Every single Disney Plus show does better with the volume. It looks more realistic, more immersive. The production design, the sets, the costumes, just everything on a technical level. It feels like ILM was putting this together back in the 80s. Like that also helps it feel like an 80s throwback. Is it feels like a classic ILM sort of project they would have done for Lucasfilm 40 years ago.
Yeah, especially if I found with this one, it was like everything, the sets, the costumes, everything looked excellent. Like it didn't look super realistic, but it looked good to me. I just really liked the look of it. Probably the best looking Star Wars show they've done, actually.
I think every one they do clears that bar.
That's true, yeah.
Every new one they release is the best looking one to date. I'll give them that. I'm generally hard on Disney Star Wars, but they are innovating a lot behind the scenes. I know it's not Skeleton Crew related, but I'll say the Bad Batch, for example. I talked about this in probably another Leisure List, I think. But the Bad Batch season 3, I thought, had near photorealistic CGI. And the way they throw those seasons together, you know, that was a 16 episode season with mostly photorealistic CGI in it. And just whatever they're doing at Disney for pushing forward special effects to make them cheaper, easier, and look better, I applaud all the behind the scenes crew working on these shows for that alone.
Yeah, so what did you think of like the actual story and everything?
The actual story is I was pretty invested in it. I think I'm not generally sold on projects featuring child actors. Maybe it's because I feel like I'm not really in that demographic. I'm not young enough to relate to kids in shows anymore, and I'm not a parent who can live vicariously through my kids' excitement of a new Star Wars show, which this show is perfect for families, by the way. It's not really targeted towards me is the thing. I'm only watching this as a Star Wars fan in general. And I think as a Star Wars fan, but just as a lover of good stories, this thing hits. The thing is that you could say all day long, oh, it's about kids, but despite me just saying I don't really relate to kids, I think they did a very good job of making these characters three-dimensional human beings with individual flaws and aspirations who have lessons to learn and maturity to grow into, and you're following along this journey with them, and they're relatable enough that despite being a grown man, I connected with these characters.
Yeah, like some of the more emotional parts, like, you know, Jaws trying to connect with the kids, especially the main boy.
Wim,
yes. There was a specific scene where he was kind of like trying to connect with him. And for me, I mean, it didn't really click the way I think it was supposed to, just because it's still kind of that child, more family-friendly kind of connection. But there were some more emotional moments that still connected.
Yeah, definitely. I thought one of the most emotionally impactful episodes was episode 6, I'm pretty sure it was. And that was the one where everything started coming together for me. That was the one where Jod finally abandoned them and they're all on their own now. And they have to start putting together the lessons they've learned thus far. And I thought the most touching part of that episode was when KB and Wim go off and Neil go off together. They make it a different pairing for the first time in the show. And I really loved how Wim has to muster up the maturity to help his struggling friend who has a disability, and she's physically shutting down because her computer doesn't have a power source, and she's a scared kid, but trying to stay as calm as possible, walking him through the steps, how to help her out. And also just that whole idea of, okay, look, I appreciate that Fern wants me to go, and she doesn't treat me like I'm disabled, but she also doesn't understand that there are things I just cannot do. She pushes me a little too far. I really appreciated that because I've never seen that take on disability where it's like, oh, well, you know, you're disabled, but you're not like a superhero who can still do everything, and you're not so crippled you can't do anything. I feel like I've only ever seen the extremes, but I thought it was very refreshing to have a take of, okay, I can still do most of the things other people can do, but I got my limits and I know them, and I just want my friends to respect them. Don't expect me to do all the things someone like Fern can do, but also don't belittle me or look down on me. Like she's very competent, but it was a very nuanced take that I'd never really seen before personally.
And usually things like that, like I don't like having stuff right in my face like that.
Messaging.
Yeah, it's only at this moment that you're like, oh yeah, it's about her struggling with her disability. I didn't even think about it like that.
Yeah.
It was so well done that they blended it so seamlessly that it's only now that I'm like, oh, wait a second.
Yeah. That was the moment I think that touched me more than anything else this season. But yeah, like I think that episode was also awesome because, like I said, that's where everything came together. That's where everything they learned in the first five episodes. I'm like, okay, now they're like, oh, Wim's piloting, they're piloting the ship, and like Wim's on the turret that he was practicing at, and shooting the ship off, and the armor of the ship, and they're working as a crew together. They've developed the teamwork and camaraderie necessary to use this ship and get back home now that they're, I'll call Jod their crutch, really, because he's the adult in the room that they all lean on, but he's very untrustworthy and obviously using them. And I do appreciate, though, that the kids kind of knew that right away. They're not stupid. They understand this guy is a scoundrel out for his own ends, but he's also their best means of getting back home. Like that one scene, and I think it was episode 2 or 3, when they are at the hideout of Jod's friend, and the X-Wings come, and Jod just straight up, oh no, those are her hired goons. And these kids who've never been a part of the New Republic, they don't know that. We, the audience, know that. Oh, those are the good guys, and he's just talking them out of it. But how are these kids supposed to know that? So I do appreciate that they're smart enough to understand that he's a liar and a scoundrel, but also realistically not knowledgeable enough to know certain things about the galaxy that, you know, we being longtime Star Wars fans are just take at face value. Yeah. So I think it was very well written in that regard. Jude Law was exceptional.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah. Jod is a very nuanced villain, which once again, I appreciate that as well. He wasn't an outright bastard. Like he was charismatic enough that you can follow him, but he was also almost fully willing to kill children in the end there. You know, he straight up threatened their parents, and like he didn't quite have it in him to actually do it in the end. But I feel like the fact that he was so like, oh, you actually have a show where you're letting the main bad guy threaten children and actually Like, he, you know, he cut off the droid's head, or like he just shot that, he shot one of his mutinous crewmen in cold blood the moment he had a chance. Like, wow, a Disney Star Wars project that lets a villain be a villain.
Yeah, and his performance was so well. He kind of kept you guessing the whole show, pretty much. Like,
yeah,
you know, what are his actual intentions? Is he, how, where does he sit on this morality? And they kind of reveal it in the end, but the whole show was like, I don't know, it was like you were playing a guessing game, like, which way is he going to go? Because sometimes he's like, well, is he a Jedi? Or, you know, and then he's like nice to the kids for a while and does things that, like, they don't even appreciate. Like, there was a scene where, like, they were all sleeping and he did something nice for them. And it's like, well,
yeah, he's not completely irredeemable. He's got his moments for sure. Like, I don't think it's a completely fake relationship he has with them. I think he did come to like these kids in some capacity, or at least tolerate them. But that's why I appreciate his performance so much. Is it was around episode 4 or 5 when he runs into his bounty hunter friend, and she calls his bounty, basically. And then all the pirates are coming after him. And that's when you start to see, okay, game time's over. I don't have time for this. I'm too impatient. And that's when he starts, you know, his inner pirate starts coming out a lot more at that point, when his back is up against the wall. And the droid's awesome. An all-time Star Wars great. I think
with the little mouse that comes out of his eye all the time.
I think one of my most quoted lines from the show, I ain't heard of no Ad-Atten. Can't say I've heard of no Ad-Atten. Yeah.
I like that there was payoff to that too. Like, it wasn't just a one-off line. They everything, that's another thing we kept talking about when we were watching it. Everything in this show tied together.
It was a very good structured season that all culminated at the end of season 1. If they don't make a season 2, it got an ending, and that's okay. Mind you, this show having a treasure planet's worth of gold seems very hard a thing to ignore in a post-Republic era. Who gets the gold? Does the New Republic get it? Did the First Order end up getting it? I mean, the New Republic discovered this place in the end. So we have questions, but what is going to be the future? Who knows? Who necessarily cares? I mean, not enough people watched it, so I guess people don't care. But if it wrapped up here, it got a good ending. For these characters in this situation, it wrapped up well. And unless you got any more thoughts on that, that's what I got for Skeleton Crew. So I will skip back a couple months now and talk about Gladiator 2, which, all right, so the thing about Gladiator is a classic for good reason. It's a modern classic, though. And it's probably up there in some of my favorite movies. Like, maybe not top 10, but maybe top 20. I thoroughly enjoy that. So Ridley Scott comes out and says, all right, I'm doing Gladiator 2, following the timeline of the first movie, and do it 20 years later. Some of the same cast are coming back. Sure. Okay. It doesn't need a sequel, obviously, but sure, let's see what they can do. And I liked it. I didn't love it. I do think if you're going to a epic swords and sandals Roman gladiator movie, it's good. But it's only good because it's basically following in the footsteps of the original. I don't want to call it a remake. It's very much, I'll be generous and call it a strong homage, but it nearly feels like something a fan of the original would have made instead of Ridley Scott making a sequel. It's like the kind of movie where, oh, well, you basically just did the first one again, but a little bit worse is all that is, which is to say it's still a good movie. But it's, I've seen this story done before, but better, effectively. I also felt the problem was the main character, Maximus's son, who the problem with him is that he felt too passive in his own story. He doesn't really decide anything for himself until the end. He mostly just lets the plot happen around him and more active characters take a role until finally at the end he decides to do something. But yeah, so he was a weak protagonist, really. Denzel Washington gave a fun performance, and Connie Nielsen was solid in her second go around as this character. I also thought Pedro Pascal was interesting for his role, because basically the movie starts with he's this Roman general who kills the wife of Maximus's son in this big battle. And Maximus's son vows revenge against Pedro Pascal. He's like, okay, I'm gonna get this bastard Roman general who killed my wife. But then later he finds out that Pedro Pascal's married to his mother back in Rome. And the subverting part was that he's actually not that bad a guy. Later his mom's like, oh, can you like promise you'll protect my son? And he's like, oh yeah, for sure. I'll do my best to do that. Like, it was just a case of, yes, he killed the guy's wife, but also it was in the line of battle, and he was just doing his job for an empire which he despises. He's working behind the scenes to overthrow the emperors. You know, he's sick of his job, too. But the main character caught him at a point where he's still just doing his job confidently, but before he's in this rebellious overthrowing kind of phase. So, like, that's why he was very interesting to me. Because it's a revenge story against somebody who's not really that bad before it pivots. The Roman politics in the movie was interesting, but not riveting. Basically, I saw this as any movie about Rome. It's basically about modern America. And in this movie, the two warring factions are the idealists who believe in the idea of Rome and think Rome can be great again if it was just under more competent leadership. And then you have the people who say Rome is an idea, was flawed from the outset, and never really existed despite the propaganda, and we'd be better off to tear the whole thing down and build from scratch. And those are the two warring viewpoints in the movie. I would say the idealists came out on top in the end. But so I guess that's Ridley Scott saying, America's worth saving if we can band together and make it better. So I'd say Gladiator 2 is worth a watch. It's not as good as the original, but it's not spitting on its grave either. Solid swords and sandals movie. All right, what's your first?
All right. So the first one I've got on my list is Free Run Beyond Journey's End.
Okay.
It's probably one of the most popular animes that came out this year. And it's supposed to be coming to Netflix pretty soon, so you might be able to watch it.
Okay.
Essentially, you've got the main character is Free Run. She's essentially... This is very heavily based on like D&D. And Free Run is like a level 20 elf mage who has outlived her entire party. Her entire party saved the world before. And now they're all dead. And it's her after they've saved everything. And okay. Her whole party is gone, right? And essentially the whole thing comes down to her just going through. She's almost reliving the quest in the modern day with two new apprentices, and they're going through the same path. Some of the stuff is like, oh, you know, we have to go back to this. 100 years ago, I said we'd go back to this town to refresh the barrier or whatever. She's got to come back. So, but everything's so easy for her because she's just super powerful. But it's really cool because she's got that elven personality where she's like, she goes in and when they have flashbacks to the time where she was traveling with Himmel, the hero, which is her friend who she traveled with, he's, you know, there's like, in the modern time, they've got statues of him in places and everybody knows who this guy is. He's a legendary hero. But when they cut back to the flashbacks, you know, she's very reserved and she's like, doesn't really get why he does some of the things. And it's really neat seeing her reflect on those things and that how she takes those memories and uses it in the modern time to teach to her new apprentices. But in the flashbacks, she's just like, she just doesn't really care. But it's not till after he actually dies that she realizes, she's like, oh my God, humans don't live that long. They don't have that long to live. And she starts to really appreciate everything that happened on their journey where she is constantly like, oh, our journey was like 10 years. And she's an elf that's multiple thousands of years old. And she's like, this isn't even a hundredth of my life.
It's a small speck in the
span. Yeah, it's like nothing to her. And so it's like she's learning to appreciate the small stuff and all that. It's really, really well done.
I like
honestly, not a lot happens in the show because everything's basically been done.
It's an internal reflection story.
Yeah. And it's so well done. The character of Freerun is so well done. And like, I could go on and on about it because it's just so good.
Yeah. I like the sound of that.
Yeah.
So it's coming to Netflix, huh?
Yeah.
Be on the lookout. All right. So this next one, I'm surprised you didn't watch because you're a big Dune guy, but Dune Prophecy. So this one is a very complex show. I'm not going to unravel everything. Effectively, it's about a bunch of different factions within the Empire, mostly about Valya Harkonnen and her time as the Mother Superior of the Bene Gesserit. And they're, while doing what the Bene Gesserit do, they're trying to create a line of breeding which will put a Bene Gesserit on the throne. And they think they have a pretty good in with the Emperor's daughter. Like, okay, well, sure, easiest way to put our person on the throne is to make the Emperor's daughter a Bene Gesserit, and then marry her off to the right person. Perfect. Seems easy. Until stuff starts going wrong. There is murders happening around the Imperium. People burning alive from the inside, including a Bene Gesserit. And they're like, how are they touching us? What is going on here? And so it's them unraveling that mystery. And then meanwhile, there is a rebellion being plotted against the Emperor. The Emperor's trying to hold on to his power. There's a bit of schism within the Bene Gesserit itself. Some people don't like Valya's leadership. They think something about her is sketchy because she wasn't really there. There's just some backstory with her where there's enough to question how she became Mother Superior and the things she's doing. But really the problem is she's hiding an AI in the basement of the Bene Gesserit, and the people, and there's only like a couple of people who know about it. But really this is a time when AI is banned, but also the AI wars were only a couple generations ago. Not even. The Mother Superior before Valya, the one who was an old woman when Valya met her, but she fought in the war, so it's not even really that far back. The people in this show, the middle-aged ones, knew people who fought in the wars. So AI is only recently banned and expunged across the Imperium. And so basically it's all about the political plotting. Everybody's trying to vie for their ends. Oh, and then there's this one guy who was a soldier, August. He's a soldier of the Imperium. He was stationed on Arrakis, and he's the only survivor of his unit. And he basically takes the Emperor's ear, starts influencing him in ways which, while the Emperor's wife hates it, the Bene Gesserit certainly hate it, starts poisoning his mind against the Bene Gesserit. And this is based on not the Frank Herbert books, but the ones done by his son and who was the other guy?
Brian Herbert.
And
Kevin Anderson?
Yes. It's based on one of their books. And effectively, this is a tide over for Dune Messiah. And I think for people who haven't read the books, me, it is said to be bridging certain weirder concepts of the Dune universe that will come more into play by Messiah. If you watch Messiah, there's probably going to be a lot of things in there that you'll say, what the hell? Where did that come from? But Dune Prophecy sort of is the Dune property in live action that's easing general audiences into some of the weirder elements of this universe.
But yeah, I think that was kind of a thing with the books itself. Every time a new book would come out, it's like, well, not when you read the next book, you're like, what? Was that always a thing? And it's like, there's nothing in the books before to prove that it wasn't, but Frank Herbert was consistently adding things to the universe. So
yeah.
The things I've read online about this show is like, yeah, it's definitely trying to make things a smoother transition. So it's not just like so jarring that it's like, oh, because especially for a movie form, you know, if something's in the background of a book and it's like, well, you can't deny that it was never there, but in a movie, the background is there. You can be like, what do you mean that light was never there? We've never seen this light before. Like
some of the sequences are genuinely horrifying for that exact reason. This one sequence in particular where one of the acolytes of the Bene Gesserit is going back to meet her ancestors, and it doesn't go well for her. All the ancestors, like just the visual representation of all her ancestors just attacking her mind and consciousness, basically. It goes very poorly. So basically with this show, one of my big problems, it was pretty expository, probably too expository for its own good, but there's also a lot going on for the good. Breathtaking production design and costumes. Every one of the planets feels unique. Awesome world building. Feels like a fully functional universe with history, and every character's got compelling motivations that they're on. It all ties together very nicely, and I'm looking forward to season 2. Expand the story further. Yeah, it's a Dune Prophecy. Pretty darn good.
All right. Next up on my list, I've got Beastars. Season 1, 2, and 3, part 1. It's supposed to be the last season is coming out pretty soon, I think. And this show was fantastic. I actually couldn't figure out the premise right away. Like, it's like, the best way to describe it is, it's like Zootopia, except for adults. And from the first episode has your main characters is the wolf, Legoshi, and he basically he's about to eat the rabbit girl. And right off the hop, I was like, so, oh, okay, I get it. It's Pops. Like, well,
right off the hop, about to eat
there. Oh, yeah, right off the hop, I see.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, so it's like, oh, guys are the predators and females are the prey. Is this where this is going? And then it was like, throughout the first episode, I was like, is this a show for women? It's definitely not. It really pivoted from there. And that's something that I discovered with anime, is that because they're based on manga series most of the time, especially like this one is, the way manga is released is they get basically one issue to make it work because there's so many and they have to catch their audience in the first one. So they always, so the first episode has to have something crazy. But a lot of times that doesn't match up with what the rest of the series is because they're just trying to get that, yes, you can continue to make more and then they can tell the story however they want, right? It's just got to be relatively close, but they try to really go all out in the first episode. So that one has him basically attack her, but he doesn't eat her. But no, it ended up being really interesting for me to watch because it dealt a lot with, I found the main subject matter was like being a man in a society. Not necessarily that men are carnivores. They had representations all throughout. But it was just really interesting that the social dynamic, and there were a lot of things, like I can't even put it to words, some of the ideas it hit on. But it was so interesting for that. And it's really discreet about it that it's sort of a, what do you call that? Like men's,
give me a little more.
Like I don't know, like men's position in society, kind of dealing with like
social structure, yeah, dynamic, like gender dynamics.
Yes. Yeah. That's the idea. And it was very interesting because he's essentially wants to, being there's so many things with him being not just like he's a gray wolf, so he's one of the bigger animals in the show, and that has a lot of things about him. And at the beginning he's really repressing his natural instincts because he knows they're bad, but then he kind of pivots and there's a lot of really, really deep subject matter that's it's layered, it's buried underneath, but it's still there, and it's just so well done. I was so impressed with it.
I think that's a theme of today's show. The stuff we like is nuanced. It's not really in your face about what does it really mean.
Mm-hmm.
Especially when what does it really mean can be touchy political topics or stuff people might get upset by if it was right on the surface for whatever reason. Sometimes having to unpack things is better. It makes you think about it harder instead of just having a gut reaction. This is what it's trying to tell me and I don't like it. If you actually have to stop and think about what you're watching and unpack the messaging for yourself, then I think you'll get more out of it, whether you agree with it or not. So my last current one, A Complete Unknown. The Bob Dylan biopic starring Timothée Chalamet. I was not a fan of Bob Dylan before this movie. I generally felt my general opinion on Bob Dylan was that he was a great songwriter who was best enjoyed through cover artists. but my opinion has now changed as of this movie. And I think that's a ringing endorsement of a biopic where going in, not a fan of this person, came out being a fan of this person and wanting to explore their works further. So at the very least, I learned enough about this subject and gained enough appreciation for him that my opinion going changed. How was the movie itself, though? The acting is exceptional, especially by Chalamet. Edward Norton is also awesome as Pete Seeger, who is another folk artist, pretty famous one, really. And a lot of the movie is about their dynamic, is Pete Seeger's a classic folk artist in a more traditional sense of the music. And Bob Dylan's this young, unknown quantity who's trying original songs and new things. And a lot of the movies, like when he first gets his record deals, they're like, Oh yeah, just don't do your stuff yet. Just sing the old favorites, the old classics. That's folk music. And he's like, okay, but why does folk music have to be that? Why does it have to be the old classics everybody knows and sung a million times? Why can't we push this genre forward to something new and interesting? And Pete Seeger is totally on board with him at first. He's very much like, wow, this kid is young and super talented, and he could be the new face of folk. Like, this kid is so talented. When he finally gets big, he's putting folk music on the map in a way it's never been before. This is, like, legendary for us. I need to foster this, until it starts kind of getting out of his control. And Bob Dylan starts experimenting with folk music. And, I mean, this all culminates, basically. This movie takes place within a couple of years in the early 60s. And culminates the first time Bob Dylan went electric. And that's the climax of the movie, because he... Look, okay, what I'll say about this. Biopics are famous for... Basically, every single biopic I've ever seen has the greatest performance of an artist's life. You know, the one that they're best remembered for. Like, the greatest moment. And I respect the hell out of this movie for having that moment in the movie play completely differently than every other biopic. Every other musician biopic has that moment be the top moment in this person's life. But in this one, it's the fact that Dylan went ahead with it. The entire time he's being booed at, he nearly caused a riot. Like, people are throwing fruit at him. Like, they hate it. And I respect the balls of this movie to say, okay, like, the most defining end concert moment of this guy's career, everyone in the audience hated it and was willing to walk out, nearly ready to walk out just for him daring to put that on. So, but like, he's loving it. You know, he's up on stage singing electric. He's singing his heart out despite them nearly willing to, like, Pete Seeger in the movie nearly takes an axe to the speaker system just to shut it down because it's so controversial and like earth-shattering for folk music. When Bob Dylan, the biggest name in folk music, basically throws traditional folk music out the window, he's like the face of this genre now, and then stabbed it in the back as far as they're concerned. And he's playing it. He's doing this show at the big folk festival as well. So it's not just, he's not just doing this in a small experimental capacity. Like, he already recorded his album. And people haven't, the people who listen to that are like, I don't know. And other people think it's brilliant. But in this setting, he really pissed people off. And that's basically the ending. He's like, well, Bob Dylan broke some eggs, but he changed folk forever with that. So I think the big theme of this movie is really about old versus new, specifically when it comes to genres. There is the forward thinkers who want to push things forward, and the old guard who maybe were more experimental in their day, but have a set idea. This is what this thing is. This is the structure, and you deviating from it. Okay, great. You know, be an artist, do your own thing, but don't play electric instruments on your recordings and call it folk music. That's not what this is. And Bob Dylan's like, well, no, it is. I'm just doing something you don't think is folk music. I'm trying to push it forward. So that's really what it's about, is different ideas about artistry and pushing things forward. Yeah. And I definitely left this film inspired to pursue creative pursuits on my own. It's like, wow, this is like tapping into my artistic center and really makes me want to write and do stuff for myself. And it's pretty inspiring in that way. It's also just very well made too. You know, like I said, acting's great, production design, costumes. Boyd Holbrook is Johnny Cash, excellent supporting character there. Yeah, I think A Complete Unknown's a must see. It's great. Exceptional biopic.
I think I'd be interested in watching that one for sure.
I think it's coming to streaming soon.
Oh, good. Good. So the next one I've got is another anime. I think it might be the last one on my list. No guarantees on that.
It's Dandadan. And this one, I didn't really know much about it going into it. And after the first episode, I sat there and was like, what did I just watch? And I was pretty much at that point, I'm like, I don't think I want to watch this again. Because it was just so weird and out there and like really overly sexually driven. Okay. Like really like subtle, but not subtle at the same time.
Got it.
And I was just like, what am I watching? You know, I heard it was really good. And I was just, after the first episode, I'm like, I gotta look up if this gets better. And that's when I discovered that thing that I talked about on the last one, where it's like, oh yeah, the mangas have to go really all out. So I'm like, okay, I will try the second episode. I'll say, after the first episode, the second episode, everything forward, was great. It was okay. Really, really good. I really enjoyed it. Essentially, your two leads are, you've got the guy, I don't remember the character's name, so this was a while ago. You get the guy who's into the occult stuff, mm-hmm. and the girl who is into ghosts and stuff. And they both have like clashing ideals. They're like, oh no. You believe in aliens and you believe in ghosts? No. So the first episode kind of has them both go different ways. So she ends up being abducted by aliens because he sends her wherever. And he ends up being cursed by a ghost in the first episode. So they both end up being proven right. Well, now they both ended up with like different superpowers because she got abducted by aliens and he's cursed with this ghost.
Jeez.
Who this ghost grandma took his testicles.
Symbology.
And so the whole show is him trying to get his testicles back. It's not subtle whatsoever, but it's hilarious. And so they got to go on this quest. It's really cool though. I'm trying to think what else. Yeah, it was really unique. It sounds weird. It is a little weird, but it's also really fun at the same time.
Sounds attention-gettingly weird. Like, okay.
Yeah, like that first episode definitely. And it's like the first episode they had to go really weird to get that attention. And then after that, when that stuff comes back up, it's because they have to follow through on it. So it's like, okay. But after the first episode, it was really, really good. I really enjoyed the whole thing. I was actually like, it didn't end on a cliffhanger like most things do. It just ended on an episode. And I'm like, oh, that was the last episode. Okay. Guess I'll wait till the next season comes out. Didn't really have a finale episode at all. It just kept going. Because it's very episodic. It's almost like a kind of similar to the X-Files, actually.
Some anthology and mythology and monster of the week. I mean,
yeah. It's set up the same way and it kind of deals with the same thing. They're kind of going with like different things every week, different monster or ghost or aliens or whatever's going on. It's really unique. I thought it was really cool.
Awesome. So next up for me, I'm going to have to start ripping through these a little. Pride and Prejudice 2005 adaptation. So, I think as far as the central romance, Lizzie and Darcy both rely on the misunderstandings trope a lot, but I felt in this instance, these ones mostly felt fair. I appreciate having a romantic male lead who's super socially awkward, yet gentlemanly and classically masculine at the same time. Which is kind of an odd mix. Like, normally these guys are, like, the suavest out there. They're, like, a James Bond or, like, the classy British guy who's just super confident. This guy was not that. He kind of comes across as a real prick for most of the movie, which is part of where the misunderstanding comes in. Because he's so socially awkward, he just comes off very badly in front of this girl until she starts
realizing who he really is. He just kind of comes off as an elitist snob most of the time, which is part of the point, because the main girl's family, they aren't rich. I mean, they have a house. They're doing okay comparatively, but I feel like that's not generally a class of people you see in these historical settings. Usually it's the working class, the dirt poor, or the wealthy and the elite. And I mean, that's more what he is, but she's, I guess, what's considered middle class in that time. So it adds some life to the period piece setting. And it's a fun supporting cast, well-written, well-filmed. Though I thought the camera work was a bit weird. I mean, this is the mid-2000s, after all. So I guess they were doing some weird things. There's like these weird snap zooms a lot in there. But the long shots, especially gorgeous. Pride and Prejudice, pretty darn good. Then The Devil's Advocate. This one was weird. So I love the premise right away. Basically, it's Keanu Reeves is a lawyer who has to live with knowing that he helps guilty people evade justice. It starts off in a court where this teacher is said to have assaulted his student, and he's pretty sure the teacher is guilty, but he basically makes the girl on the stand look really bad in front of the court. It makes her look like an attention-seeking liar and gets the teacher off on an acquittal, even though he knows the teacher was guilty of the crime. But his whole thing is about ego, is he really doesn't want to lose his winning streak. So then this leads him down the rabbit hole of in Al Pacino's law firm, where they handle these big international clients, and it's very sketchy. The more he gets into this law firm, the sketchier it gets. He finds out that they're basically representing very bad people. And then, this is one I'll debate talking about, because I said I wasn't going to spoil like big twists, but I feel like I have to talk about this one because it's the twist comes before the end. Al Pacino's the literal devil. Yeah, let that sink in a moment. The movie's The Devil's Advocate. You think it's just, oh, it's a lawyer's. It's just a lawyer's thing. He's like, he's representing bad people, but Al Pacino's the literal devil and he's working for him as a lawyer.
Oh.
Yeah. So then the entire last act of the movie is nearly like a short film in its own right, where they're basically just riffing back and forth on the morality. Like Al Pacino is really, he really wants Keanu Reeves to join him. I remember some line where he's like, well, you know, God had the 20th century, but the 19th, like every century before, but the 20th century can belong to me. Basically, the general tone of the movie is, it's weird because mostly it feels like a grounded lawyer drama, but then becomes super unhinged and off-putting and sometimes downright horrific. Yeah, so I think there was great moments in it and themes as well. And so it's basically like, how can you put aside your own ego? And like, this guy is just giving you everything you could possibly want. So can you put aside your own ego for the greater good is basically the main theme of this film. And Al Pacino's just like scenery chewing the whole time in it. Charlize Theron was great in it too, despite having a thinly written character. She's Keanu Reeves' wife in the movie. But Al Pacino was the standout because the story took turns I didn't expect. But I'm not sure I liked that he was the literal devil. It was like, okay, you're getting really on the nose now, but like this is, it's so interesting. It's hard to turn away, but it's also like, well, I think you jumped the shark here at the same time movie. Like it just kind of passes that point of, okay, you were a mostly grounded lawyer drama, and now it's a movie about the literal devil. Okay. Let's roll with this, I guess. But worth a watch for sure.
All right. So what I got next is Spaceman with Adam Sandler. This movie was pretty good. It's nothing to write home about. Adam Sandler is okay in it. Some of his acting is a little weak at the beginning, but as you go, it gets a lot better. It's basically Adam Sandler is an astronaut. He's on a deep space mission to like Saturn or something. And he's been gone for a year. He's on like a 2-year mission. And essentially, he's having marital problems with his wife, who's on Earth. And this giant spider alien invades his spaceship. And it's friendly. So it's basically him hanging out, talking his problems out with this giant spider. The camera work is really interesting. The background and the props and everything, I was looking it up, was all from old NASA, all old NASA parts. So it's really realistic looking. They did something unique with the camera where instead of doing your typical, like, we're going to make this look like a Hollywood movie, you know, make sure it's not so sharp looking and so crisp. They really just went with a modern digital camera look. And at first that threw me off a bit. But I actually grew to like the style, especially the way it worked with the CGI, because the monster spider is obviously CGI, but it still looks really good. You just know it's so realistic looking that like the movements and stuff, because it's so crisp and clear, you know for a fact that it's not a puppet or anything. And it's the way I would like CGI and filmmaking to go, because we should be upgrading our look of things. It should be going towards a more modern look. We've been stalling on the look of movies for like 30 years. And I kind of like seeing a step forward like that, and also having CGI be more obvious rather than not really knowing what's CGI. So I thought that was really cool. The only thing I was disappointed with this movie was the end kind of came down to him basically just being like, oh, it's all my fault, with his wife. But meanwhile, the whole story showed that it was a very nuanced issue between them. And it kind of fell apart. The story fell apart at the end, but I would still recommend watching it because it's really good actually. But yeah, it just fell apart on that side, which was a little disappointing, but overall it's not bad.
Okay, that's cool.
So I know I'm going to catch some flack for this one online. So, you know, there was Simon Pegg and Nick Frost's Cornetto trilogy. Shaun of the Dead, Hot Fuzz, and The World's End. I haven't seen the first two, but I watched The World's End. So, the thing is, this is really only one of those... It's really only one of those trilogies in that they follow similar things, have, like, recurring motifs in them and whatnot. It's not like these are the same characters kind of trilogy. It's more of a thematic trilogy. So basically, The World's End is about this washed-up guy played by Simon Pegg. He's an alcoholic. He comes from a small English town. All his friends have moved away, made good lives for themselves. But he's this guy who peaked back in high school. And the greatest, what was supposed to be the greatest night of his life was when they did basically this pub run where there was 12 pubs in their hometown along this line called the Golden Mile. And they'd have to hit all 12 and reach the World's End, which is the final pub. And they never got to do it when they were kids. So he gets all his high school buddies back together, most of whom hate him now because he's borrowed so much money from them over the years. And he gets them all back together to do the Golden Mile. And then they find out that all their town's been taken over by robots.
What?
As they're doing the Golden Mile, people don't recognize them. Things are weird. They're like, what the hell's going on? And then they get into this this knockdown, drag out fight in the bathroom, and the guy's head pops off, and they find out he's a robot. And then they find out that over half the people in the town are alien robots. They're alien robots, too, by the way. So, yeah, this is another movie. I guess this is a theme of mine tonight, too, where things seem to be going one way and then just go completely off the rails. This is another weird one because I kind of liked it better when it was just a story about this alcoholic who is trying to recreate his high school glory that he never got. But alien action movie as well. On top of that, Simon Pegg exudes a charming energy despite his character being a real piece of work. Lots of witty humor, not often the type to make me laugh out loud, but the banter is quick and clever. The internal logic in the movie starts feeling pretty forced, but all right, just you kind of have to roll with it. Surprisingly fun action sequences, though. Really well shot and edited and delivered, so The World's End is worth a watch. And then I watched The Master, which was fine, I guess. It's Philip Seymour Hoffman, Joaquin Phoenix. Basically, Joaquin Phoenix joins Philip Seymour Hoffman's cult, and Joaquin Phoenix is kind of the outsider character, never really fits in anywhere, and Philip Seymour Hoffman gives him a sense of belonging, a community, and sees him as a kindred spirit. So basically, it's them in their cult together as the cult is building up, and eventually when it starts getting exposed and winding down, and Joaquin Phoenix's character, who even from the start isn't that intelligent a person, he's very he's got a strong temper, and he doesn't really do very well anywhere for himself in his life. So it's about how place organizations like this rope people in and manipulate them using the flaws of themselves, make them feel like they belong, and well, how could it be any other way here? And it's an uncomfortable story with great central performances, where the filmmaking itself even sets the viewer at unease. Some people would be put off by the fact that none of the characters are especially likable. But it's, once again, it's about the nuance in it. Everyone's got their motive. Like, even the main character, who's kind of a victim in this situation, he's kind of a prick, too. So it's a little hard to get invested sometimes, but it's a good story. Worth a watch, for sure. What you got?
You should definitely watch Shaun of the Dead, by the way. It's
I know.
It's very well done. You'd really appreciate that one.
I know I would. I'm strongly confident in that.
So I've got Kingsglaive. It's the movie for Final Fantasy 15, which I talked about, I think, last time.
Yeah.
It's great. It doesn't feature very many characters that you would know from the game. I would recommend watching this before you play the game, because it really sets up the antagonist very well and sets up the kingdom that you don't get to see very much of in the game. And the main characters are in it for like 5 seconds, and that is a straight, like, shot for shot would blend right into the very beginning of the game.
Okay. Wow.
And it's just it's gorgeous looking. It really sets up the world really nice, and I would definitely recommend, if you're interested in Final Fantasy 15, watch this movie first.
Sure.
And then play the game.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's a good recommendation. So next up for me is, I lost my spot. It's a Wonderful Life. Clearly we're going back to around Christmas here. So I was mostly surprised to find that everyone knows the ending of this film, basically, where George is up on the bridge about to jump in, and then it's on Christmas time, and then the angel saves him and shows everybody what life would be like without him, right? Everybody knows that part of It's a Wonderful Life, but that's just the ending of the movie. That's not most of the movie, which was mind-blowing to me. I'm like, but this has nothing to do with Christmas until the end, basically. So the rest I call a well-earned 90 minutes of build-up until he's on the bridge. Makes you really contemplate why this guy is in a position where he wants to jump off a bridge on Christmas. But also it sets up his final lesson and the payoff very well. Basically, his thing is he spent his entire life self-sacrificing for the good of his community. He gave up pretty much everything he wanted to do to end up stuck in the family business just so that the rich old loan shark in town wouldn't have a monopoly on the town's finances. He was the good money lender who was actually helping people in the community and not gouging them for pure profit. And also sacrificing things in his personal life, like, oh, his brother went off and got married and joined the army and became a war hero and lived this pretty awesome life on the outside. And he's like, well, crap, that could have been me. Except if I was just running the family business until my brother came back. And then he went off on a completely different path and left me stuck in my little hometown. And even with his wife, too, like every aspect of his life is just self-sacrifice, which just breaks him down over time, especially when he feels like nobody really appreciates everything he's done. But then in the end, that's why the ending is so impactful. When he goes, the angel takes him back through his life, and you go basically with every character and you see how much worse the town and everyone in his life, how much worse off they are without him, even going back to the very first scenes when he was a kid. Just the things that he did for them created such a better life for his community. Like if George Bailey died, or worse, if he'd never existed, the world would be a worse place. Which is why that, like, the movie really got to me, because personally, it's the most life-affirming piece of art I've ever seen. It demonstrates with utter clarity the value of a human life, well-lived, even when bitterness and depression and hard times make it hard to recognize that life's worth. It just shows that the value inherent in every single human being. And it definitely got me emotional by the end. Jimmy Stewart, spectacular throughout. George Bailey's a very fully conceived character. The townsfolk are great supports too, especially his wife. Just it's a great cast all around. It's a Wonderful Life fully exceeded my expectations. It's among my favorite films now. Very quickly. It really strongly impacted me, and I think it's watch as soon as possible. Yeah.
Okay, so next up I've got ReZero Season 1 and 2. I lied. This is another anime.
There's always more anime.
There's always more. There's probably, like, at least two more. This show's pretty good. It's essentially guy gets sucked into a fantasy world and finds out when he dies, he loops back.
Okay.
And so it can be a little bit tedious at times because you feel like it's definitely got a case of the main character is not very smart sometimes. And it's very, the emotions are very heightened. But other than that, the story's kind of interesting. The world's kind of interesting. I'm curious to see where it goes. I know there's a third season that's out. I haven't seen it yet. But I definitely will watch it.
Okay. Next up, I've got Kindergarten Cop, which is a classic Arnold Schwarzenegger movie. So this movie is, it's all right. Okay. So the main character, Kimball, he's very single-minded on getting rid of this drug dealer. And basically the only way he can do that is by finding the drug dealer's former girlfriend and his son who were at this school, but they don't know who they're looking for. and his partner is supposed to be the one who's this kindergarten teacher, but then, because she has some actual teaching experience, but then she falls sick, and, oh, Arnold Schwarzenegger's got to teach kindergarten now. He's this tough cop guy. So one thing I liked pretty early on was how the dealer that he hates so much, like, calls Kimball out blatantly, basically, for harassment. Like, you're after me very obviously right now, and, like, I just need you to, like, okay, like, I know you're the guy after me. Got it? He's just so cocky. There was a lot of... Kimball is sort of presented as a bad boy cop in the mold of Dirty Harry. That archetype hasn't necessarily aged well, but still badass. I was surprised at how shockingly little action there was until the third act. Like, the first act is like, okay, he's kind of like action hero sort of guy. There's Arnold Schwarzenegger, like, dealing, like, using guns and beating people up. It's cool. And then he's mostly just a kindergarten teacher for most of the movie until the very ending. Which, funny enough, the action parts were less enjoyable than the kindergarten teacher bits. Felt more forced, if anything. I thought it was interesting how low the stakes felt for most of the film. Though I was more upset when the drama was quickly undercut instead of built upon. It's very like, okay, well, we can't feel emotions for too long, okay? The villains were two-dimensional but kind of entertaining. Pamela Reed and Linda Hunt were great supporting characters, tons of personality. Most of the jokes in this thing aren't my cup of tea, but the tone is light. Not much beneath the surface as far as I'm concerned. Just cheesy, cozy, feel-good comedy with some action and romance for good measure. Worth a watch.
All right. So next, I listened to the audiobook version of Hooked. This was pitched as like a modern gangster retelling of Peter Pan. It wasn't. It was until it wasn't. And then I was like, almost halfway through, and I'm like, wait a second, is this a smut novel? It totally is. So I'm going to review it as such, because I'm not really into that stuff, but I was already more than halfway through. I'm like, I'm just going to finish it.
If you think you're not into that stuff, you haven't found the right one.
Maybe. That could be true. Anyways, I was disappointed in it. After I realized that it was a smut novel, I was like, what the heck? There's only like two scenes in the whole thing, and I'm like, well, that was lame. I would be, you know, if I went into this expecting a smut novel, I would be severely disappointed. I'd be like,
where's what? This is plot.
Where's the smut? This is just plot.
You put plot in my smut novel.
Yeah.
How dare you?
For being fairly long, I was surprised how much plot there was and very little smut that was like really short too. I was like, oh, okay. I don't know how well that goes over for people who like smut novels, but I was a little disappointed once I realized what it was and that it didn't follow through on what it was. So
that's funny.
Yeah, that's all I got to really say about that one.
I feel like you're getting through these faster than I keep going 1-to-1 with you when I really should be doing 2-to-1. I feel like I'm way behind now.
I'm only like, I'm not even halfway through my list.
Oh boy, gotta get moving. Okay, Roadhouse. This movie is ridiculous. It was good in like the first half and then fully jumped the shark into a full-on action extravaganza. Basically, it's just about a bouncer who's trying to... He's like this legendary bouncer. I didn't even know bouncers could be legendary, but all right. So he's trying to like repurpose this seedy club into a place that's halfway respectable. And the local town's, the local evil businessman guy is trying to buy the place up. He's just like, he basically owns the whole town and is very mafioso about it. Like, oh, he'll blow the place up that doesn't pay him protection money. He's trying to extort the club this same way, except Patrick Swayze has this team of like badass bouncers that he's trained that like keep the gangsters out. Once again, interesting premise in the first half, and then it goes like way too far into a full-on action extravagance. Like they're blowing crap up. They're like it becomes like it feels like an Arnold Schwarzenegger 80s movie by the back half. I'm like, what happened to just being a bouncer trying to clean up a seedy bar? That's what the first half was. Jeez. Because the stakes felt so grounded in the first half, and then it just like I'm watching a different movie. This is weird now. But it's mostly a fun time still, with cool fight scenes and a good leading performance. It's all right if you put it on in the background, I figure. Next up, Anna Karenina. Another Keira Knightley romance movie. Except this one is a lot more tragic. Basically, I mean, it kept me anticipating what would happen next. I think that's one of its biggest strengths. But basically what it's about is it's in 1800s in Russia, and the wife of this politician, played by Jude Law, actually, basically is having an affair with this army guy, this younger army guy, which is super scandalous, effectively. That's basically what it's about, this big affair that comes out and ends up ruining her reputation and sort of drawing a line between her and all her friends in society. It's like, okay, well, you can have this romantic love affair with this guy who can't really support you, or you can publicly denounce him and go back to your husband who you don't really like. So basically, it's do you choose love and have all your friends and community ostracize you, or do you keep most of your social connections but live in a loveless marriage? That's Anna's choice in the movie. And I think it was played, Keira Knightley played it pretty well. I think the problem with this movie was the direction, because it was unique but distracting because it was so frenetically paced. There's also this weird thing with like all the transitions. Like everything is nearly done like it's like an expanded theatrical production set nearly. There's stuff like, oh, to get from one scene to another, we're walking through the rafters or something, or like, oh, we're gonna come out on like onto a stage or something. Like it was just this weird framing device where it looked like everything was this weird faux mix of theatrical and like just film, like normal film sets like you normally see. I don't really know what they were going for there. It feels like a stage play, but also a film, but not enough of either to be enjoyable. Like, it's weird. I think the problem is it didn't set up Anna's ordinary world well enough for us to care about her abandoning it. And her main love interest is a pretty thin character. He's just hot. That's it. That's as far as his depth goes, really. Another one, I think, okay, if you put it on in the background.
All right, so I watched Squid Game Season 2. I would say I liked this one more than the first one. There was a lot more set outside of the actual games, which I thought in the first season was done really well, but it was so short. This time, I think it was more than half the season. There were probably like 2 or 3 episodes before they actually got into the games again. And it was great. It's fantastic. The filmmaking is excellent. Everything always looks good. And I really respect that they went a different direction with this. They kind of played the games, but it was more, basically, he goes back into the games to destroy it. And so it's taking the same concept, but going at it a completely different way. And it was really neat how it was done. And, you know, they've got some characters have 2 roles to play at the same time. And that makes it kind of unique. And it's just, yeah, it's good. I'm looking forward to it. They're claiming there's one more season and then that's the end. And yeah, it's just as good, if not better, than the first season.
Now, I think what you told me, which is you told me this in our own private discussions about this, but the thing that was interesting to me was when you talked about the theme of the lottery, basically. I think you said it's basically summarized in the first scene where somebody goes around giving homeless people lottery tickets or bread. Do you think the thing that'll help you today, or do you take the chance? And that you described as a central theme of the season is we don't, like, these people would be safer and arguably better off not doing these games, but they're all desperate enough to take the chance instead of saving their lives.
Well, what was interesting was that they know this guy is coming back. They know he's back. They know who he is. And it's almost like they changed the rules for the game this time. Every time there's a game, they get to vote. And if the majority says that they end the games, they get the money. Which last time there was a vote to end the games after the first game and everybody could leave. But and then everybody ended up coming back, basically, because they were like, no, I actually need the money. This time they're like, No, if you guys can leave at any point, we'll let as the majority votes to leave, you can take the money you guys have earned now and split it and leave.
Yeah.
And they're all like, this is going to be so easy. We'll just vote to leave. You know, who's going to want to stay after seeing all these people die? But they had that at the beginning. They had the micro scale of it. And to be like, almost all the homeless people pick the scratch cards and not the bread because they would rather gamble on, you know, completely changing their lives rather than the little bit. So, and that theme went through into the actual season. And it was almost like they're trying to prove that point to him specifically because they know he's there and he's like, oh, this is bad, right? And they're totally trying to be like, hey, look, we gave them options. We're not the bad guys here. This is their choice. So that was really, really cool. I'm curious to see how they continue with that.
So next up for me is Annie, 1982. Basically, it's, well, if you've ever heard just the concept, it's a little orphan Annie. She's a cute little redhead orphan girl who ends up getting a placement at this billionaire's house. He's like the richest guy. This is pre-World War II. This is set. And, well, he wanted a boy, but he ended up getting this girl instead. And basically, I think it was just for promotion or something. It was just, hey, this guy's so good. He gave an orphan a place to stay for a weekend or whatever. He wasn't setting out to adopt her. But effectively, she's just so cute and charming and adds depth to his life he didn't know he lacked as this hard-hearted, greedy businessman that he ends up really taking to this orphan girl, and that's effectively what it's about. And it's a musical. I thought a big problem I had with this was the look of it. It looks like it was made on cheap film or something. I don't know if it's the cinematography or the film stock, but it looks muted and a lot less vibrant than you'd expect from a musical or even a movie from 1982. Even to its contemporaries, it doesn't look that great to me. The actors, I'd argue, aren't the best singers personally, but the dancing part was very well done. The main kid is awesome as Annie, despite her being sort of a flawless protagonist sort of figure. Personally, the main standout of this film was Carol Burnett as Miss Hannigan. Just this awful, the lady who runs the orphanage, who's just super abusive and mean to the children. Carol Burnett's really funny in that role, which weird to say for like, oh yeah, you abuse the children, but it's Carol Burnett. It's funny. And it's not like that excessive. I like most of the songs in it, although there was only a couple I was really I found memorable exactly. So yeah, it's another one that's all right if you put it on in the background, I figure. My next one around Christmas time was another musical. This one was called Journey to Bethlehem. And this is a story every Christian's familiar with. It's basically the story leading up to the birth of Jesus Christ, about a young Joseph and Mary, picks up with them before they're married. It's about them kind of getting to know each other and the struggles that they have to go through before the birth of Jesus. The music was well performed, but personally kind of blurred together. A lot of the songs sort of sounded the same. And the comedy bits were too goofy for me. The three wise men bits specifically were a bit overwrought. I also thought the era in the movie looked too clean and sanitized, and the sets and the costumes looked kind of cheap. But the main actress and Antonio Banderas as the villain, they were really good. And I also thought the movie explored some interesting ideas. Like, I don't think I've ever seen a take on this story before where it was like, oh, people thought Mary was crazy. Like, oh yeah, God impregnated me. Like, no, for real. For real. And like, everyone just like, yeah, right. Which is an interesting take. And also Joseph as well, debating whether he's betrothed to her and then she ends up pregnant and everyone's like, oh, well, yeah, no, just break off the engagement. Like, this girl's clearly just been sleeping around. And he's like, well, I don't know. I kind of believe her, though. And it's sort of about earlier on, it's about him kind of struggling whether to believe this insane sounding story. And also the son of the evil king, Herod, he's questioning his allegiance to his father as well. Like, these are interesting aspects of the story I never really have seen shown before. So it's just kind of a fun musical. Another put it on in the background, though, maybe. Yeah. And then I'll just do a third one quick. Simpsons season 13, which, okay, yeah, now we're starting to see the dip off in quality, for real. I don't even laugh out loud every episode anymore, though I still laugh out loud for most of them. There are a few character-focused episodes that stood out as well done. Although, perfectly frank, these mid-years are still on par with above-average sitcoms that I've seen. So, you know, Simpsons 13, another put it on in the background, but like, you could do worse as far as sitcoms go.
So it's starting to lose the focus then.
Yeah, I think, you know, seasons 3 to 8, I agree with the consensus that that's the golden age. And then 9 to 12 is like, okay, we're starting to dip off compared to the golden age, but like, it's still really funny. And now season 13 is like, okay, now we're starting to trail off into average sitcom territory. But I'm still pushing through.
So I read the first Overlord light novel. I've talked about the anime before. So I've seen the whole anime and I was like, oh, you know what? Is the book going to add that much? Yeah, actually, it does. If you think about it, there's 4 seasons of the anime. There are 16 books. And all the 4 seasons covered all 16 of those books. The next season, they're waiting on the guy to write the books right now. So you can imagine how much they had to condense it. So I only read the first book so far, and it was just really neat getting to see a lot more about the characters, especially when the anime, you know, the first episode introduces you to so many characters just in the main kingdom of Nazarick. Right away, you've got 10 floor guardians, and you need to know the background of, like, there's a lot of characters we don't see. There's 42 supreme beings who are the original players of the game before it becomes a real place, and only one of those guys is still around. But the other 41 are there in spirit because they've designed all these different parts of this kingdom, and all the different NPCs are kind of tied to these people. And you don't get as much of that in the anime, but in the books, they really kind of push into that more because of the way the author, the reason the author started writing it in the first place was it was about his D&D group falling apart and his friends losing contact with his friends. So that was what his friends were, what really inspired this story. And you don't see a lot of that in the anime. And so this first book really delved into it. And I really liked the way, also getting to see kind of the way the ideas are subdivided into the books. Like I have the other, couple of the other books, and just seeing the titles, I know what kind of section that is in the anime. So it's kind of cool seeing where the author's ideas are really separated as well. But it spends a lot more time on each of the characters. And especially with having so many to need to know. And that's just the one kingdom. There's tons of characters in the outside kingdoms. And I'm excited to see how they handle those. And, you know, there's just so many characters in it and so little time that there's no way they cover all of them. So the book is a if you like the anime, the books are like definitely a go-to.
Awesome. So my next one up here is Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey. So this one is absolutely wild. Wild Stallions. It's all over the place, really. Although whether that's good or not is completely subjective. I admired the sheer scope and strangeness, though. In this movie, they literally die and end up in heaven and hell.
All in one.
They're traveling around with the manifestation of death. They meet God and the devil. It's literally all over the place. Keep in mind the first... Oh, and there's the time travel element as well. It starts off with the bad guy from the future stealing the time machine and sending evil robot versions of Bill and Ted back to the past to kill Bill and Ted. And then they do kill Bill and Ted. And then Bill and Ted meet the manifestation of death and have to go to... And then they end up in hell after they die. But then they end up going to heaven to trick God into sending them back to beat their evil robot selves and save the future. It's a wild movie.
Sounds complicated.
I just explained the whole plot, but that's it. Whether that sounds intriguing to you or not, I don't know. But it's this movie featured pretty diverse sets and camera lens choices. I really thought were pretty cool too. Understated, but actually kind of good special effects and awesome performances from Keanu Reeves and Bill Winter. And I don't remember who played Death right now, but Death, Bogus Journey. I'm not seeing his name right now. Whatever. Sorry. But yeah, the movie is just pure fun and vibes. Don't worry about the plot or divulging really any meaning from it. I don't know if there is much, but it's best enjoyed scene by scene because it's funny. It's not very deep, but it's endearing. It's like the first one I thought was a lot better personally, but the second one is just nuts. It's worth a watch. This next one, Fanboys. I loved it just for the premise alone, which is basically, so the movie's set in... I forget if it's 1998 or 1999. Basically, Phantom Menace is 6 months out. And all these nerds are desperate to see it. But the one nerd, he's got cancer. He's dying. And he's not going to live to see the premiere of the Phantom Menace. So all these nerds decide, all right, we're going to make sure our friend sees the Phantom Menace before he's dead. We're going out on a road trip to Skywalker Ranch, and we're going to steal an early cut of the film and get him to watch this thing. So the entire movie is basically the road trip of these fanboys out to Skywalker Ranch to steal a cut of the Phantom Menace. And yeah, I mean, they run into some Star Trek fans along the way, get into fist fights with them. There's awesome cameo appearances. Sorry for spoiling, but my favorite one was William Shatner. He's the guy that provides them the floor plans to Skywalker Ranch to break in. They're like, Will Shatner, why are you're helping us? Wow. There's a lot of references to the movies, obviously, sprinkled in conversation. Those were on point because you actually need to pay attention and know them to understand what references they're talking about. This movie actually got George Lucas's approval to use official Star Wars sounds. So there's like official Star Wars sound effects in the movie as well, which is pretty fun. Basically, this movie is about friendship and bonding over intense love for media or intense loathing for competing media, like the Trekkie rivalry. Fanboys never really had big laugh-out-loud moments, but I chuckled almost consistently throughout. The vibes were right. It's not great, but it's solid entertainment. Definitely worth a watch. And I really, maybe even pretty good. I'm kind of on the line there. But I really enjoyed the very ending, because even so they after the very ending is when they're finally at the like the actual Phantom Menace premiere, because most of them don't end up seeing it, obviously, because it was a crazy idea to begin with. But they get to the Phantom Menace premiere after like all this craziness they went through, and the last line of the movie, guys, I just thought of this. What if it sucks? And well, this movie is more fun for being made in like 2009, because we all know what happened. They can end the movie that way, and we know what happens after the fact. But I think that's part of the beauty of it, is we all know going in advance. Oh yeah, and there's also another great one, like when Seth Rogen shows up in a cameo, and he's like this avid Star Wars fan who's got this giant tattoo of Jar Jar Binks because he's convinced he's going to be the next big thing. Like, like this movie can have some fun with its premise. We know what people thought of The Phantom Menace. But
the movie sounds amazing.
Yeah. I think any Star Wars fan should definitely see it.
What's it called?
Fanboys. Yeah. So that was our, I guess, December leisure lists. Trying to keep it under wraps here. So where can we find you?
You can find me on Instagram at jchurchtpm and on YouTube as Thought Plane Media.
And you can find me on Instagram, TikTok, and Facebook at Thought Plane Media. Also, check out the Close Up with Ryan and Joe Facebook page for latest updates on the show. If you listen to us in audio, check out our YouTube channel. And if you're on YouTube, find us anywhere you get your favorite podcasts. Also, check out thoughtplane.ca for even more of my leisure lists, non-spoiler. That's where I'll include the novels and video games and comic books and other stuff that I didn't want to include on these. So we hope to see you on the next close-up with Ryan and Joe, next part of our leisure lists. Till next time.
Take care.